But if you're a developer, you know, Googling around, or you're on Stack Overflow, it's quite hard to find what you're looking for because you're phrasing it in your language, development language. I want to specify CPU, I want to specify memory. The actual searches you need be quite ops focused.
Hi, you're listening to The Secure Developer. It's part of the DevSecOn community, a platform for developers, operators, and security people to share their views and practices on DevSecOps, Dev and Sec collaboration, cloud security, and more. Check out devsecon.com to join the community and find other great resources. This podcast is sponsored by Sneak. Sneak is a dev-first security company, helping companies fix vulnerabilities in their open source components and containers without slowing down development. To learn more, visit sneak.io, S-N-Y-K.io. Welcome back to another episode of The Secure Developer. On today's episode, Guy Pajani, president and founder of Sneak, is joined by Daniel Bryant. Daniel is the director of developer relations at Ambassador Labs. His technical expertise focuses on DevOps tooling, cloud and container platforms, and microservice implementation. Daniel is a Java champion and contributes to several open source projects. He also writes for InfoQ, O'Reilly, and the New Stack, and regularly presents at international conferences such as QCon and Java One. We really hope you enjoyed the conversation, and don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to The Secure Developer. Thanks for tuning back in. Today, we're going to take a walk more in the developer's shoes. And to help us do that is Daniel Bryant, who is the director of DevRel at Ambassador Labs. Daniel, thanks for coming on to the show.
Yeah, thanks for the invite, Guy. Always great to chat to you.
So Daniel, before we dig in, we'll talk a lot about kind of the new reality of developers and specifically as it comes to security. Tell us a bit about what is it that you do and your journey coming into it.
Yeah, so at the moment, Guy, I'm director of DevRel at Ambassador Labs. So working on a lot of strategy around how we engage with the communities, how we talk about our tools, how we help developers. And we also listen a lot to developers and the challenges they have with developing microservices and Kubernetes in particular. So learning a lot from a lot of very interesting folks across all range of communities, Java, Go, Node, Python, many commonalities, many differences, right? It's very interesting, like learning from different folks. My background, I like to say my native programming language is Java. You know, I've done Go and JavaScript over the years, but Java was, I cut my teeth at college, at university on Java, and it was the first commercial language I used. So I actually started as an academic. I did a PhD. I don't talk about this that much, but I did a PhD in AI. I wanted to be a lecturer. But I discovered, it's one of my sort of random facts, but I discovered halfway through the studies that I was doing some moonlighting Java development and web development, and I really enjoyed the practical side of the work. So I finished the PhD, but I moved into more software engineering. So I worked from everything from the UK government to small startups. I was consulting in London for a while with an awesome company called Open Credo, still going strong. And I got to see all sort of walks of life there. I worked with financial companies, I worked with e-commerce companies, and I worked with some amazing people, both at the company there and also all the engineers I got to see on my consulting travels. So one of my strengths I sort of understood over the years was the ability to bridge between the super techie folks and the other folks, stakeholders, customers, developers, end users. And that's led me more into the role I'm doing at Ambassador Labs now, being the bridge. You know, we are very much engaging with developers, but perhaps they don't know Kubernetes super well. Perhaps they don't think about security. They don't think about observability. They don't think about testability. And my role is partly sort of meeting them where they're at and bringing them along on the journey with all the experience I've had doing all this stuff in the past.
Yeah, super interesting. And, you know, a problem that is more relevant than ever. Just for context for folks, you know, can you tell us a bit about Ambassador Labs just to, again, relate, you're talking about stuff that you do in your day to day. You know, what's the context here?
Yeah, we are focused on minimizing friction for developers to deliver value. And bold statement, but we recognize a lot of folks are modularizing their architecture these days. They're moving to microservices, all these good things. They're moving to platforms or foundations of platforms like Kubernetes. Now, Kubernetes is a fantastic foundation. I chose that word deliberately there. It's not a fully functioning platform like you may see with Heroku or Cloud Foundry. So we give people the tools, the practices, and the processes to create the platform experience they need on top of Kubernetes. And it's all about being able to find what's going on, fix problems, and you may be actually fixing it in sort of a production-like environment or a staging-like environment, our telepresence tool, we use that a lot, CNCF tool. And we also talk a lot about releasing. We're really interested in things like progressive delivery, which is sort of an extension to continuous delivery, and you know, observability. Even things like security come into this, we're really keen to enable developers to close that loop. You know, you have the business idea, you develop, you test, you release, you observe, you understand, and then you kind of close the loop with your next steps. And you're always looking at things both from like SLIs from a sort of more lower level infrastructure kind of vibe. Security definitely falls into that as well. And you're also looking at kind of KPIs, more of a high level business goals as well. So we enable folks to kind of understand and close the feedback loop on that.
Got it. Thanks for the overview here. So the real kind of topic that we want to dig in here is really this reality of developers. We talk a lot in security about, you know, shift left or top to bottom or dev first security and how, you know, we want to move security into development. But we kind of take this sort of lens of saying, hey, developers should pick up security, and we kind of put aside or oftentimes forget or choose to ignore the fact that there are many other words other than security that complete that sentence of developers should also care about. And that's a bit of a tough load to move to developers in this reality. So maybe let's unpack what that means a little bit. First of all, what do you see as the key umbrella terms, kind of big ticket items that are moving to the responsibility of developers, you know, above and beyond security? What are the other things they need to battle with?
A lot of it boils down to the illities. Okay? You know, we used to call them non-functional requirements. Now we call them cross-functional requirements because, you know, non-functional requirements is a bad choice of word sometimes, right? They are very much impacting the function.
Part of the functioning, yeah.
Yeah, it's 100%, right? So for me, a lot of it starts with observability. Whether you're looking at it from a security lens, from a testability lens, like even from a understandability lens, because we are building these complex adaptive systems now, right? Being able to think about and bake in observability early on is really key. And a lot of developers, you know, myself included, when I started my journey, it was more about you look at the functional spec, you code it up, you test it from that angle, and you ship it, and you're kind of good to go. But now we need to understand, how is it performing? Is it costing us a lot in the cloud? Is it sort of, you know, would the algorithm be better to be tuned a certain way to give you more performance? And what are we exposing in the application? And without having metrics, quality things like logs, traces, sort of the three pillars, as a lot of folks talk about, of observability, without baking them in on day zero, it's really hard, I find, to retrofit those things in. So for me, it often starts with observability. If you can't understand your system, if you can't ask these kind of ad hoc questions, it's really hard to do all the other things in terms of, you know, layering on security, layering on resilience. You know, if something breaks, you don't want it to take down your entire system. But if you don't understand like what's breaking and what the impact is, it's really hard to do that. And then you layer on even things like maintainability, extensibility. Again, the ability to observe, to understand is foundational for that. In order to actually successfully expand your system, you have to understand the pain points, you know, the friction points. If you think about things like, you know, value streams from a business context, it's the same in engineering, right? I've worked in a few systems where we were tweaking the system to be more performant, and we didn't actually know if we were tackling the bottleneck, right? It's really ironic looking back on it why we did it, but, you know, now I would say, right, let's run lots of tests, understand where the bottlenecks are, understand where the problems are, and fix that thing first. But I've definitely worked on a few teams where we guessed at where the problems were and we dove in and we sometimes fixed it, but we sometimes didn't.
Yeah, I've had my creates flashbacks to the world of purify and quantify, you know, from the early days, you know, where I spent a decent amount of time there trying to understand memory allocation or speed. You know, I never really kind of applied the term observability to it, but really that's what was lacking there, which is we had these tools and we just didn't know where the time was going or where the memory was going. A lot of it. So I guess if I go back, and I think I'll add a couple to your items, is there's kind of the testing or testability. Arguably, that's been the original requirement, or maybe the original requirement was to build functionality, and then testing is moving more and more into dev. Presumably, they were already responsible. Developers were already responsible for building something that functions correctly, but the process of testing it is probably the first thing that sort of moved. Maybe that's an agile movement shift. So maybe kind of predates. And then you're adding observability as an underpinning to what we talked about, resilience, and we mentioned performance. So I think those are good ones. And they're all related to security, but they're not the same. So security is clearly on the list. I guess two others that I would add. One is probably a bit more niche, but it's accessibility.
Interesting. Yes.
And it's, I guess it shouldn't be niche, but it's just not as big an industry. And so it probably doesn't come up. But maybe an interesting one is privacy. Now, we didn't touch on this too much, but you also play a role in InfoQ and QCon. And so I'm kind of tapping a bit also into your view of what you see submitted there and what you see discussed. How much have you sort of seen privacy rise in terms of like a developer-oriented or developer-first privacy, or, you know, the requirement for developers to care about privacy needs?
Yeah, that's a great question, Guy. I've definitely seen it sort of from a couple of angles with the QCon conferences, for sure. In Europe, we have the GDPR regulation that came in recently. There's the California version. There's various global implementations of a very similar approach. And that has definitely raised that topic with developers. Now, the team leads, the stakeholders are saying, right, make sure you store the data in a GDPR compliant way. You know, we've always had perhaps PCI DSS with financials, but now things like GDPR are really sort of raising the stakes. So we're seeing a lot more folks pay attention to those kind of things. And I think the second thing I'd say as well is more from an ethics standpoint. We're seeing increasingly, you know, with machine learning in particular, right, you know, encoding bias in algorithms, these kind of things, and just how you're exposing data and whether folks can actually sort of join the dots on some of the data. So we've seen an increased rise at QCon around the interest of ethics, just because you can do it. Should you do it?
Yeah.
Right. So there's those kind of angles that are becoming quite interesting.
You know, I actually wrote ethics right after privacy here in my notes, which I agree. It's a hot topic that is largely driven just by the power of tech versus, you know, necessarily the development processes. But again, decisions are being made at development time. And so that's the time to consider it, because later on, just like any one of the problems we talked about, it is more expensive to address it.
100%.
So we have this sort of long list of requirements, if you will, or sort of, you know, full-on spaces. How do we start? What would you say are the building stones to allow a dev team to be able to tackle any one of these? You know, what do we need to provide a dev team to do so successfully?
Yeah, another great question, Guy. And I think it's often two-pronged, right? There's the education piece. We need to work with our engineering teams or anyone just to upskill and raise awareness. It's the unknown unknowns that always get you, kind of thing. Perhaps some education really helps with that. And then it's providing tooling to support this. And I think a lot of what we see around modern tooling is this notion of self-service. So developers are, as we've said already, becoming increasingly responsible end-to-end. You mentioned testing, observability, and developers like to engage with tools in a certain way. They, you know, self-service, I want to plug my thing into GitHub. I want to make it a GitHub action. I want to put something in a Jenkins pipeline that automates these things. Or I want to run the tool locally, but I want to do it via the CLI. You know, you need to meet, I think, the engineers where they're at. There's a temptation back, you know, when I was doing a lot more engineering, is we sort of got delivered these tools. You know, you're going to run the security scanner using this web UI or this, you know, swing.
Like it or not.
Yeah, exactly. And it was horrible, right? As in, it was typically clunky. Sometimes you had to run it on Windows, and we were all using Linux machines to do our development. Just a nightmare. So I think it is meeting folks where they're at and giving them that self-service tooling to facilitate that smooth, frictionless experience of coding, testing, releasing.
Yeah, I think those are really, really good kind of guidelines around meeting them where they are. And I think meeting them where they are is not just a technical statement, right? It's also almost a mindset element, right? Meet them where they are also means acknowledging, heck, for starters, you know, what we just talked about, which is they have a bunch of these other requirements in front of them. But one of the questions that I keep debating in my head, you know, sounding a bit more loony than I, or maybe like precisely as loony as I am, but it's really the combination of them. So when you think about education, then presumably education is its own topic related, right? You know, when you talk about how to build an accessible application or a secure application or an observable application, there's some overlap, but they're probably 80% unique to their sort of subject matter. But from a tooling perspective, we've sort of been seeing more merging of things, right? I can say that in Sneak, you know, for example, we came into it with a dependency management, right? So the security risk that we're tackling, that we tackled in the sort of the original product, is really one of vulnerable libraries. But from a developer perspective, you also had the problem of maintainability, of being able to just like keep up to date with these dependencies. And it made sense to make it a part of the same product from a developer lens. Do you think these would end up with more disparate tools? What's your view on how to balance the sort of single purpose, because it's already observability, for instance, you know, it already gives you visibility, versus the kind of purpose built, it's for security and it's masterful at security, or it's masterful at something else?
Yeah, I think it's a pendulum swing, guys. There's a temptation to want one tool to do it all. And then there's a swing to the other way of like, we have a very specific tool to do a very specific job. And I spend a lot of time in the CNCF ecosystem. And at the moment, there's a tool for everything, basically. And it almost leads to the paradox of choice as a developer. You're like, should I use X, Y, or Z to do the same thing? So when I look at the industry, exactly as you said, there's consolidation happening now. And there is this notion to, you know, observability tools also offering remediation or security fixes. And I think that's a good thing because, you know, developers, there's only so much room for us to sort of, you know, it's a cognitive load, right? We often talk about cognitive load. There's only so much room for us to understand all these different tools. And if we're having to, you know, as part of our regular tool chain, use 10 or more tools to accomplish our job, that's a lot of context switching. That's a lot of cognitive load. This tool does it this way. This tool does it this way. So I would imagine over the coming years, there's going to be a balance. So we're definitely seeing consolidation, but I think some tools will be specific to the job. Do you know what I mean? They're just so niche perhaps, or they need to have a certain UX for them to be functional. But I think we haven't as an industry fully found that sweet spot yet. And a lot of things that we've been talking about today, you kind of have to think about them in terms of security and observability and testability. You have to think about them. So the tooling should nudge you in that way as well. So I think we're definitely going to see some sort of tooling popping up that just either encourages the developers to think about all these things or actually verifies how they're doing, and then suggest perhaps, you know, other tools, other practices that can help them think a bit more about what they're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I guess it's the assisted versus, I don't know what the end of that sentence is. It's about surfacing a problem to you, and then it's about assisting or kind of helping you actually address it. And then I guess the end of that road for a chunk of problems is to actually do it for you, right? You know, the sort of the problems with serverless things moving into the platform and maybe just removing, going the other way, or maybe completing the circle, which is just removing it from your sphere at all. Do you see that as the path? You know, I kind of wonder whether that path to no code is just the inevitable journey of all development processes. Is that how you see it as well? Or
that's a very thought-provoking question. So you mentioned InfoQ earlier on. We're seeing a lot of interest in low-code and no-code platforms now, the so-called citizen developer, community developer. I'm personally fascinated by it. I've seen low-code, no-code tools throughout my 20-year career, if I'm being honest, sort of business process modeling tools and other things, which, you know, I've still got the scars from some of those, right? I do think we're going to see a lot more adoption of those low-code and no-code tools. But I also think there's going to be a whole long tail of different options, right? You know, I don't see VMs disappearing overnight in the classic software development process, you know, even kind of classic Scrum type processes or even waterfall processes. I don't see serverless being the panacea for everything. I don't see no code being panacea. I think we will get clearer abstractions and also clearer value props for each of those things. At the moment, there's a temptation to say, you know, serverless solves all the ills of having to run Kubernetes, for example. But you're making that trade-off, right? As in, if you're running on a serverless platform, you're sort of trading off the running and the configurability of that platform to the vendor. You're happy to say, hey, you know, you run it as good as you can for me. I'll just put the code on top and run that. And that's a nice trade-off, right? Because often the vendors do look after all the illities we've talked about by doing that. And low-code is even more, right? It's just kind of we're knitting things together from pre-configured options and all the utilities are done for us. We assume the platform's going to do those. But you always have this long tail of existing systems. Some folks, rightly or wrongly, think they're unique, so they want to build their own bespoke solutions. And you know, sometimes this is true, right? Perhaps some governmental organizations do have specific requirements around data security, around privacy. The data cannot ever leave their geo, for example, is a classic thing. So therefore, they may have specific requirements that do mean they're going to build systems a different way. So I think we're always going to see a gamut. And I think the end of the spectrum around low code and serverless is still quite young and it's going to get a bit more refined. But I think for the career you and I have in the future, we'll always be dealing with some form of Kubernetes or VMs or whatever. Yeah, even though they may be very abstracted, there'll be something like that running in the background.
Yeah, I think technologies just never die. You know, they take a long time to support. I mean, it's interesting. What you're describing is the pros and cons of constraints, right? The more constrained the system, the more the system or the platform can do stuff for you. Assuming it does it well, then it removes a need from you. But the more freedom you have, then the more opportunities you have to shoot yourself in the foot. Serverless is an interesting one because, you know, I talk a lot about serverless security, and serverless is... On one hand, take something simple like server patching, like operating system patching. That problem goes away. You know, you're running a serverless system. Someone else is managing the servers for you, including the patching of them. It literally is a full security concern layer. It just gets moved onto the platform.
Nice.
At the same time, serverless didn't constrain your use of libraries. And so the same risk exists within the libraries. And lo and behold, it's been multiplied because with serverless, now you're going to deploy 10 times as many functions as you would have containers. So suddenly the risk of a binary in your kind of operating system being unpatched and being vulnerable, that went away. But the risk of an unpatched library in your code is now multiplied tenfold, you know, the likelihood that you would have it because there's nothing else that helps you. You still need to build a process around it. And so it's every one of these things kind of, you know, closes one door and open another. But I do think, I guess my view of the low code is that it is a trajectory and that it'll be helpful for us. Increasingly, I think there are lessons to learn from the low code coming from the other side of the continuum about how do we simplify developers' lives, right? How do we take practices that they have over there? I'll give a tactical example. There's a company, a pretty cool startup called Salto, S-A-L-T-O, which is trying to apply development practices to BizOps systems. And what Salto does, for instance, they have this little fun, I'm not affiliated with Salto, right? It's sort of just something I liked with their tweak, is they have a thing where you can actually go to the BizOps system, say whatever, some Salesforce sandbox, you can modify things live in that surrounding, and then you can pull those into code. Because in that surrounding, you can modify this. Now, I think in the cloud world, for instance, we don't really do that, right? In the cloud world, we say, well, you have to go back and code it, and then it would be applied to cloud. Does it make sense for you to be able to go to a console and modify something in the AWS console or whatever, and then pull that back in to code? Now, I can argue for and against it, but I'm just saying it's the types of conversations of innovations happening in the world of BizOp that might actually even apply to us further back when you think about easing the lives of developers.
That is interesting. But definitely something I've seen a lot in my career was the use of Excel as the kind of original low-code platform, right? I've worked with some amazing people that could do incredible things with Excel, right? And I remember thinking like a few times like, oh, I could code that up in a couple of days. And then they'd literally do a macro and 10 minutes later, it'd be done, right? So I'm just thinking that that's an interesting kind of trade-off there, right? If I could design it in Excel or an Excel-like UX and then pull it out to code, I get the best of both worlds, right? I can understand, I can maintain the thing a bit better. But that's a very interesting thinking point. Yeah.
So let's maybe talk a little bit about removing obstacles. So we have developers, we need to educate them about these challenges, and you know, we need to equip with relevant tools. But what have you seen work the other way around? Or, you know, what primarily prevents development teams from picking things up? What do you see as the key blockers? And feel free, I don't know, you can live in the world of Kubernetes and complexity. So maybe even if we even use that as a case study and say, when you look at developers needing to understand Kubernetes, needing to adapt their work to work in a Kubernetes surrounding, what are the biggest obstacles or problems, things developers are having a hard time embracing, and why?
Yeah, I think in the Kubernetes space specifically, and then these are definitely sort of personal views I'll have that, because really the community around Kubernetes is just fantastic. It is quite an ops-focused community, though. So a lot of tooling being built is fantastic, but I notice when I'm learning it and I pop along to GitHub or I brew install something, I have to switch my ops brain on. I'm like, what's this thing doing? Oh, it's doing this. How is it doing that? And then I find myself, when I'm chatting to my developer friends, sort of reverse engineering what I understood through the ops lens to say, you know, here's the problem space it's operating in, here's the benefits, and here's how you use it. So I definitely see a lot of companies, it's what we're doing in Ambassador Labs, right? Shameless plug, but we are making it easy for developers to get all the advantages of a platform like Kubernetes. So I think that is one of the key blockers. And that, you know, it's a fair blocker, right? Because Kubernetes has come from the ops perspective. You are orchestrating containers. You are, you know, doing a fantastic job on ephemeral hardware and all these kind of good things. But developers have different goals in mind. I want to deploy my app super easy. I want to give some Rust specifications of CPU, memory, sandbox capabilities, that kind of thing. And I want to be informed of what's going on there. Well, those are sort of very different goals than, like, you can almost imagine the ops responsibilities behind them. But if you're a developer, just, you know, Googling around, or you're on Stack Overflow, it's quite hard to find what you're looking for because you're phrasing it in your language, development language. I want to specify CPU. I want to specify memory. And then the actual searches you need be quite ops focused. You know, I want to specify policies. I want to do resource constraints, quotas. And I think we are seeing this sort of bleed through of language now, whereas the more ops focused developers are taking this stuff on board, but it's a whole, you know, 95% of developers just want to write code and deliver value in a safe and effective way. And I think that one of the key blockers in the cloud and space in general is there's so much to learn before you can do that, right?
It's fascinating to hear you say that, because oftentimes in security, we talk about DevOps as the role model of somewhere that, you know, it's been done right. But I agree with you, which is, you know, a lot of elements in ops are still very opsy in kind of this world of DevOps. So they are probably more developer friendly than most of their sort of security peers, but there's still sort of a long way to go around really kind of rethinking, I guess, at any one of these problems. Maybe if I generalize a bit the sort of the practice and how we can tackle these concerns, that we need to kind of go back to first principles and say, well, if I'm a developer and I'm now being tasked with a new field of responsibility, can we start by saying, what is a developer first X here?
Yeah.
What do we need to do it? So in Snickland, when we talked about open source security and we talked about dev first security, some of the kind of core examples of what that manifested were the Git integration. So being able to just, like, you know, move to Git flows, the automated fix pull request, because the developer's job isn't to find issues, it's to fix issues. We had the dependency tree for libraries, because historically most tools kind of gave you a list of flat ones, you know, versus as a developer, you're like, I included these 10 ones and they pulled in these 100 and
yes,
500. What are some examples that you've seen, or maybe that you're even doing at Ambassador, that are different? Are there a couple of examples that come to mind of how to rethink, I guess, kind of Kubernetes development for that developer lens?
Yeah, it's all about the abstractions, I think, for us. And sort of we're doing a lot of work around service catalog at the moment. So Ambassador Cloud product, recently we added the service catalog. And that's the jumping off point for understanding the system. Can I understand all the various components over and above a kubectl describe or whatever, or a kubectl get services? That again is quite an opsy focused perspective. We're saying, hey, here's all your services. You can add metadata to them so you can easily understand who owns what the service does. And from there, it's all about making it easy to do your core tasks. So can I very easily roll out a new version of this service? And to your point, Guy, around sort of connecting up to Git, we do integrations with GitHub and so forth. We can just say, new version of the service has been deployed. Can you progressively roll this out? And, you know, Argo is a fantastic project, a CNCF project. It is somewhat ops focused. It gives you excellent config options and you can use all your standard Kubernetes approaches to configure Argo. But we're trying to abstract some of the key things away for that. So developers can just pop along to the portal, they see their service, I've committed some new code, press this button. Can you roll it out 10% of traffic for the next 10 minutes? Do some tests, make sure, is it from a SLI, from a service level indicator perspective, from a KPI, business level perspective, is that new service performing well? If so, roll out the traffic to 30%. So 30% of the users are hitting that back end, do some more tests and so forth. The abstraction points there, rather than having to learn lots of Kubernetes YAML, like if you're in the Kubernetes space, you know, so, you know, to love and hate YAML, right? Not all developers want to do that.
Yeah.
So we're trying to make, yes, you always pop the escape hatch, right? And have a look at some of the Kubernetes config, but your core tasks, such as releasing and even things like debugging, we're doing a lot of integrations with our CNCF tool, Telepresence, making it easy for folks to go, ah, here's the problem service, going to find quickly, fix the problem, quickly test it, get those fast feedback loops going on, and then release in a controlled fashion. Now, that is the key things back, you know, from my sort of early Java monolith days, it was a binary release, right? You simply deployed and release it at one time. And it's very tempting to do that into the Kubernetes land. So we're making it as easy for folks as possible. And I think you'll see that just in general, there is a big push towards providing these key platform abstractions that every developer wants on top of Kubernetes. And we're trying to make it as easy for folks to adopt, understand, and use those abstractions.
Yeah, definitely interesting. And it's almost, I'm probably overstretching it a little bit, but you can separate the notion of DevOps as in operators working as developers, which implies, you know, a lot of the tools in the space have become development tools. They're software driven. They work off Git. They do all of those, from saying, can I have a non-ops developer, not a DevOps person, not a person that ops is their primary identity, be able to operate successfully on their own? And in some areas, I think we've successfully done so, right, with PagerDuty and the whole kind
of
being on call, many aspects of observability. I think New Relic was probably more designed for developers, at least originally,
than
it was for operators. So while it's an observability play, and I think a lot of the industry that followed, maybe Datadog was even better for ops. You know, it could be that New Relic actually jumped a couple of steps too far ahead.
Interesting. Yeah.
So it's interesting to think about it. But it's just the separation between dev tooling and an app developer. We almost need a different name for it, right? You know, we need an app developer versus an ops developer.
But now you mention it, Guy, there is some interesting work going on with the OAM spec. I don't know if you bumped into that. I think Open Application Model and Microsoft are doing a lot of work in this space. And it's and Crossplane. I bump into the Crossplane folks quite a lot. And they are talking about three core personas. And off the top of my head, I can't think of the exact names, but they are talking more about sort of app developers, platform folks, and then infrastructure folks. So there's a delineation between the infrastructure are kind of literally assembling the platform. The platform folks are tailoring the platform to the development experience. And the app developers, to your point, simply care about releasing their apps. So I'm following the OAM spec quite closely. There's a lot of interesting work in that space. And I think just the conversation we've had, we're leaning in towards that. I think many other folks are coming together on that terminology too.
Yeah, of course. No, much smarter. Always smarter people around thinking about these things long before you raise them. So maybe let's spend a couple of minutes on Indeed Community, use this a bit as a good segue. So a part of having developers tackle any new space is really around having the community around them start educating, right? You can expect developers to start going to a security conference and an ops conference and a privacy conference, et cetera. How much of that type of change have you seen when you look at, if we use QCon as an example and you contrast 5 years back versus today? Are you seeing a significant difference in the topics that come up? Do you see these new areas of responsibility rising in prominence in the talks and the conversations in those events and communities?
I'm seeing sort of two broadly interesting things. The security track, we've always run a security track at QCon because we realize the importance of these things. But the popularity is increasing. We've had to move it to bigger rooms. When we were doing in-person events, we've had to move security to bigger rooms. And the level of engagement around this has gotten better. More folks provide comments. And generally, the security track attracts a certain kind of person and they give very constructive feedback. Like this, often the security talks perform very well. A lot of the speakers sort of know the audience and vice versa. They listen to the feedback from the audience and each year it gets better and better. So I'd say that from a pure security track point of view, it's becoming more popular. There's definitely a dive into the deeper level of security now. I think we're definitely seeing that in security tracks. But the interesting kind of counterbalance to that is we're seeing security mentioned in all the other tracks. Right. So the architectures you've always wondered about is our marquee track, where we look at, you know, the architecture of Netflix, we look at the architecture of a lot of the unicorns, Google, Amazon, or whatever. And now you always hear a reference to security. You hear a reference to observability too. And to your point, Guy, you hear often references for testability too. Like the Amazon folks, they've got their builders library they're talking about at the moment. They've got a fantastic resource online. We've seen them talk at conferences too. But if you look now, it's not just about the boxes and arrows when they talk about architecture. It's not just like we designed a system like this. They're saying these are the constraints. These are the requirements. We had a zero trust architecture because we recognized that threats are coming from everywhere. We baked observability in from day zero because we realized, you know, we needed to understand these kind of things. And it's popping up even in other tracks. You know, there's the microservices track, often mentions security, even the culture and methods type tracks. There are historically more human focused tracks. You know, how you integrate DevSecOps, you know, we've had some fantastic talks around, is it really DevOps and security? Is it DevSecOps all together? And how do you encourage leaders to think about these things? You know, how do you sort of like, the agile coaches are getting people to think a lot more holistically now. And thinking holistically, thinking in terms of systems, a lot of system level thinking, security is a big part of that, right? Observability, testability, big parts of these things. So I think there's a notion of some of the tracks becoming more specialized, but a lot of these things we've been talking about today are bleeding into all the other tracks too.
Yeah, I think probably that latter, like the security track is important, but it's almost a conference organizer's decision. You know, you can be mindful of it versus a community indicator. And the presence of a topic as part of the existing tracks is probably even more of an indicator of true community engagement and appetite to say, yes, well, when I'm talking about this, I need to address this. This has been a conversation I really enjoyed about the new reality, you know, for developers and maybe some of the things we can do as an ecosystem. Maybe, you know, if before I asked about 5 years forward, I'll ask you as a final question here to take out the crystal ball and look 5 years forward, not backward, I guess I asked before, and say, what do you think if you're in your position, you know, trying to lead the community towards, I guess, dev first understandability, I think you called it, and such. Yeah. That's your reality today. You know, someone in your position, in your type of job in 5 years' time, what would be most different about their reality?
Yeah, it's a great question, Guy. And I think riffing off some of the things we've talked around low code, no code, and citizen developers, I think more and more people are going to be developers in air quotes, if that makes sense. And that brings fantastic opportunities, but it also brings challenges. You know, we talked about meeting folks where they're at, and that's going to be a big challenge for a lot of us with an engineering background. We're very comfortable with fellow engineers, right? But when you start getting what we would historically call business folks involved in the mix, and let's be honest, we're all business folks, right, to some degree. But when you start getting folks, you know, that are coming up with fantastic ideas, doing POCs, or even bigger systems with these low-code, no-code approaches, you do have to think that level deeper as those systems get more adoption. You do have to think about sustainability. You have to think about cost. You have to think about security, all these things. So I imagine part of my job in the community is going to be really taking the time to meet folks where they're at. You know, now it's some degree of, are you a Go developer? Are you a Node developer? Are you a JavaScript developer? And I think now it's going to be 5 years in the future, it's more around this goal-oriented idea that we talked about, you know, earlier in the podcast. It's like, what are you trying to achieve? It doesn't really matter whether you're a Go developer, a low-code developer, whatever. What are you trying to achieve and what are your constraints? So I imagine the job in particular for the DevRel is going to pivot a lot more to even more thinking about empathy, meeting folks where they're at, and they're understanding the problem space before then guiding folks to, here's your options, here's your tools, here's your practices, here's your platforms. So I'm super excited. I think, you know, the whole sort of developer education space is going to be super interesting over the next 5 years. You know, I think software is eating the world, as the cliche goes, and, you know, Kubernetes and the internet is eating software. There's just more and more opportunity for us. And I think it's just really paying attention to the folks coming aboard and their goals.
That's a fairly fair description, you know, or I would subscribe to that crystal ball, you know, of the reality changing. And now it's just a question of timeline. Is it 5 or 10?
That's it. That's it.
Yeah. Cool. Daniel, thanks for coming onto the show. This has been great.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
And thanks everybody for tuning in. And I hope you join us for the next one.
Thanks for listening to The Secure Developer. That's all we have time for today. To find additional episodes and full transcriptions, visit thesecuredeveloper.com. If you'd like to be a guest on the show or get involved in the community, find us on Twitter at DevSecCon. Don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes if you enjoyed today's episode. Bye for now.